You're listening to the 22nd episode of the Armand and Akil Show, bringing you interviews with local activists, politicians, and policy experts from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Akil Krishnan.
And I'm Armand Rana. We're recording this on Saturday, the 30th of November at 5:10 p.m. We are broadcasting live from UBC's Vancouver campus, located on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territories of the Hankam Mi'kmaq-speaking Musqueam people.
Armand, how's it going?
Not bad. Last time we spoke, Trump had not yet won the election. Now Trump's won the election. I guess that's the big news.
Is that big news?
I was just down in the States last week.
What's the pulse like over there?
It was interesting. I was going down through the more rural areas, a lot of Make America Great Again posters. And then once you get to the more liberal areas, I saw a bunch of like Black Lives Matter signs popping up. So yeah, it's just still as polarized as ever. I think the regional polarization was obvious, from the numbers. And I think you can see that visually as you're going through the various neighborhoods. How about you?
I've just been, there's a lot of news that's gone on. Trump won. There's a lot, whenever anything big happens to Trump, like he becomes a nominee, well, the last time he got elected, there are so many things that everyone starts speculating about. And I guess that's kind of par for the course when you have a candidate or an elected who says like a billion things.
Yeah, and you don't know which of these he's going to actually execute
on. And it's more interesting this time around because people kind of know what he's already done, right? I think last time what ended up happening was people thought, well, yeah, he said all of that to get elected, but now it's going to be okay.
Yeah, and I think last time as well, there were a lot of more establishment Republican figures. Wasn't yet Trump's party. Now it's like
absolutely
Trump's party.
Right? Not just that. The last time around, they didn't expect to win, right?
Yeah.
So you read stories of
they
like after the fact, after they exited, right?
Yeah.
You read like documents, for instance, that said of Jared Kushner saying, oh, can we keep some of your stuff on after the end of your presidency? And so the Obama guy's like, no, you got to stop the entire White House.
Now they have Project 2025.
Right.
So what are we talking about today?
So we do have a guest on the show who's joining us in a bit. But just to quickly get this going, we're going to talk about city council and something that happened. That was quite interesting. So just to give some context, city council, a better city, ABC party, has a majority. The mayor's in ABC, and they have
the legendary Ken Sim.
Owner of, Nurse Next Door and Rosemary Roxall Bagel.
Yeah.
Are those in blind trust? That's my question. So there was basically a motion in council to discuss the ban on natural gas in new constructions. And the motion was to basically permit natural gas to be used in new construction, basically remove the ban.
And then there's a provincial ban coming in anyway in 2030.
Exactly.
Assuming the NDP is still in power provincially in 2030, because the Conservatives, if they come into power for 5 years from now, they want to reverse that. So
exactly.
This is kind of...
But it's not actually to the substance of the question itself. What we want to talk about is this exchange between Councillor Montague and Councillor Pete Fry. And is there any other context that we need before we play the clip?
Yeah, no, just go ahead.
All right. So you're going to hear Councillor Brian Montague talking in City Council.
I have a point of order.
Sure.
And it's regarding Section 6.1B of the procedure bylaw. And I understand councillors are permitted to have an opinion. But early this morning, you made a specific point of expressing to the gallery and the people in council chambers that we shouldn't be clapping or cheering because it's intimidating to staff. So yet I see Councillor Fry and Councillor Carr have signs, visible signs on their desks. And I feel that's intimidating to the speakers that we're going to have. I feel it's like it's intimidation and it's they're basically saying that they don't want to hear them. So I'm asking that the chair decide whether or not this is a breach of the policy And if so, they should take down those signs.
Okay.
So that was Councillor Montague basically saying that the signs need to be taken down. And now let's listen to our all-knowing mayor, Ken Sim, and just what he has to say about this.
My comments here, just so we're all clear. So a couple of things. Unlike a public hearing, councillors technically don't have to enter into this chamber with an open mind. So I was actually kind of shocked about that. The second thing I'll bring up, though, is I think we have to lead by example. There have been numerous times in this chamber where people have brought signs in the audience, and as a council, we've actually cleared the chamber. Also, earlier today, based on previous experience over the last couple of weeks, there was an expression by our team members that they felt intimidated by actions of the speakers that came in. And so we have basically highlighted the fact that that's something that we won't tolerate. And so I bring this all up because I know how hard it is for people to come here, to stand up there. There's like a fear of speaking. It's nerve-wracking. And if there's an opinion that's expressed that may not be aligned with councillors in this chamber or the mayor, it's intimidating at the best of time. And I think it's incumbent upon us to create a safe environment for everyone so they can express their feelings. And so I will agree with Councillor Montague and Section 6.1, which states a council member must not, 6.1b, by words, tone, manner of speaking, or gesticulation, express any opinion or make any allegation that directly or indirectly reflects negatively upon the character of any person or groups of persons. I think it's relevant here. And I would hope that the councillors here, instead of fighting this, points taken, you got your shot in the media, let's create a safe environment for everyone who wants to actually have their voice heard in this chamber. And they may not agree Mayor, with you, but that's healthy.
Mayor, I have a point of information.
Sure.
Because on Monday we'll be in chambers today. Is the procedure bylaw breach that's being alleged related to the signs that are on display?
Yes.
And if maybe perhaps, I don't know whether the city manager or another councillor could address, is that not artwork that was brought to City Hall today by children or in representing children?
I don't know if that's necessarily relevant. You can make an extreme case if a kid brought in artwork that was completely inappropriate.
I guess I'm asking, Mayor, is what's on display, is it defamatory? Is it calling into question people's behavior? I'm trying to understand, is it highly offensive? Is it insulting? I'm not there, so I can't see it.
It very clearly expresses an opinion as to where people stand on this issue. And I think it...
So that was a bit of a long walk to get to the end there, but I think it was worth listening to. And you should really look at the clip for our listeners because he really, he kind of gesticulates and prevaricates a little bit, but it's quite interesting how So earlier in the day, there was some cheering and applause for some of the points being made by some councillors. And councillors Pete Fry and Adrian Carr had taken issue with that and basically said, look, that might intimidate people from speaking. So this was more of a tit-for-tat thing where they're like, oh, yeah, but guess what your signs are pretty intimidating too.
Yeah, and they're children's drawings of like an orca, and they're saying like,
stop climate change.
Stop climate change. Stop natural gas. And they're like literally 5-year-old drawings of like the earth and, you know, those kind of things. Very intimidating, highly inflammatory content, as I'm sure we can all attest. And yeah, we need to create a safe space for LNG lobbyists when they come to present to council. It's just so interesting how that all that language has been like weaponized in reverse. Like it's just gone the full cycle. But moving on, that was just a bit of comedic relief in terms of how our city council is spending its time and energies these days. What do we have? Do you want to shift to our guest?
Absolutely. So to the exciting part of the show now, joining us in the studio over the airwaves is Dr. Robin Chaban, a competition expert and founder of the Canadian Anti-Monopoly Project. I'm going to just make sure we can actually hear them when they come online. Hi, Robin. How's it going?
Good. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Perfect. The system works.
Excellent.
So welcome to the show. Thank you for being here. So just to get us started, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and why you decided to pursue public policy and study competition as a career?
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here and to talk about issues around competition and monopoly. My study and advocacy around these topics really comes from this mission I have for myself of helping people and the Canadian public understand how our economy works and how it's not working for a lot of people. You know, more than ever, we have greater levels of worker precarity. We have less opportunities in terms of employment, but also too entrepreneurship. The level of startups and entrepreneurship in our economy has been declining over time. And that poses a lot of challenges as far as people's ability to create and deliver something new to Canadians that actually creates value and improves people's lives. So there are some things that are broken in our economic system that have a cascading effect into our healthcare system and our education system. And so the study of competition and monopolies is really part of my understanding of really unpacking why we have these broken aspects of our economy and how we can fix it.
Yeah, thanks. I just want to drill down deeper. Like you, like as an individual, at what point in your life were you like an undergraduate student? Were you in high school when you started to get interested in, you know, in these sort of topics? And what was it that led you to be interested or get curious about these topics? Or did you, like, I don't know, grow up in some, you know, anti-monopolist collective or something?
No. So I studied economics in university, and I was drawn to economics because it fed that part of my brain that loves mathematics and that linear thinking, but also it fundamentally is about people, right? And it's about the well-being and welfare of people in a particular dimension, right? In an economic dimension, but that also has implications for our psychological well-being and our physical well-being. And one of the things I was really drawn to was competition and competition policy. And the reason why is because these issues around how our markets work and how marketplaces meet the needs of people is so central to our economy, right? We work and live in a market-based economy, and we can debate whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but the reality is that's the system we live in today. And I found it fascinating to learn about what makes markets tick and what makes them work well for people. And that took me to my first job out of university, which is as an officer at the Competition Bureau, which is the regulatory agency that enforces Canada's competition laws. It's a federal agency, and its job is to enforce the Competition Act, which is the antitrust or competition laws of Canada. And I was drawn to this because I could see a true connection between the economics that I studied in school and how this can impact people. My experience there, though, was really disappointing. Really, what I was doing was rubber stamping mergers and acquisitions.
Oh, wow.
And what I learned in that environment was that our systems are really not set up to not only enforce our laws, but actually create regulations that support people and create markets that actually serve the needs of people. Our competition policy system was frankly really captured by the corporate interests that they were supposed to be regulating. And so I quit that job. I quit that job, and it was some years later that I decided, you know what, I need to do a PhD on this topic. And so I enrolled in a PhD program in public policy at Carleton University, and I sought out to really unpack, why do we have such a weak regulatory system that privileges so-called economic efficiency or profitability over the economic well-being of actual people that live, work, purchase in our economy. And it was through that journey that I found other people that felt the same way. And they had come at this issue from different paths, but ultimately we came together to create the Canadian Anti-Monopoly Project. And CAMP, as we call it, that's the acronym, is a nonprofit think tank and advocacy organization that is striving to curb monopoly power in Canada and create a more fair and equitable economy for everyone.
Fantastic. You know, that answer captured in like a small way so many of the areas that we did want to touch upon. So that's an excellent segue to all the questions that we have and that we want to discuss. One of the things you mentioned is, you know, your experience at the Competition Bureau. And, you know, a question that often comes up is, are the laws inadequate, or is the Competition Bureau toothless? But it sounds like it could be a bit of both. So could you tell us a little bit more about what the law allows the Competition Bureau to do, and whether or not the enforcement is in the spirit of the law and is as extensive as the law allows it to be?
Yeah. So like I said before, Canada's Competition Act is the main legislation that regulates mergers and acquisitions in Canada. It also governs what are called abuses of dominance. So if you have a business that is very dominant in a marketplace, think, for example, the telco companies, right? They're very dominant. There's mainly just three telecoms. And those are the three choices we typically have if we're searching for a cell phone plan. Airlines is another great example where there's lots of dominance. So when you have these marketplaces where dominant firms are abusing their dominant position, according to the law, then the Competition Bureau can take action to stop that dominance, that abuse of that dominance. The Competition Act also regulates misleading advertising. So if, for example, you go on the Ticketmaster website and you go to purchase a ticket, and that process takes you through links of different pages, and before you know it, you get to the checkout page and there's all these taxes and extra fees added on. Drip pricing is typically what this is called. That can be misleading advertising, and that could be a contravention of the act. So those are some of the key areas the Competition Act enforces. I'll also add too, it also covers collusion. So if you have two businesses that are getting together and colluding to fix prices, that's also illegal under the Competition Act. And some examples of that that the Bureau has investigated are the price fixing of bread across Canada by different grocery stores. That's an example of something that's illegal. So onto the point of, is the Competition Act sufficient, or do we lack teeth in the act? There's still a lot of improvements that need to be made, but over the last few years, there have been some really significant changes to the law that gives the Competition Bureau more power to actually address harmful business behavior. And that is in large part from the advocacy efforts of CAMP, as well as some of our other allies. And there was a real need for this change and a growing awareness of the harm that monopoly power can cause. And that was a big motivator for these legislative changes. The Competition Bureau has also been taking more steps to be more aggressive and proactive in their work. And you're seeing that with the Competition Bureau's attempt to block Rogers and Shaw from merging. So a couple years ago, Rogers wanted to purchase Shaw, two telco companies, and the Competition Bureau fought hard against that. And actually, that case went to trial to the Competition Tribunal, which is a special judiciary body. It's like kind of like a court that hears these merger cases. And unfortunately, they lost because at that time we lacked the tough legislation needed to actually stop that merger. But it shows that the Competition Bureau is stepping up and taking these issues more seriously. So the tide is turning. We see both politicians and law enforcement taking competition and monopoly issues more seriously. But there are more changes that need to happen in order to truly calibrate our system to benefit people.
Yeah, just that was super insightful. Just on, you know, still on that topic of the Competition Bureau, you mentioned earlier that it was captured or you perceived it as captured at the time you were there. Could you describe, like, what is the incentive structure, the mechanism by which, you know, you believe it gets captured, and do you believe it still is captured, or has that, you know, incentive structure changed in some way?
Yeah, so I'll say under this current commissioner of the Competition Bureau, Matthew Boswell, he's done a lot to clean up the kind of muddy relationship that the Competition Bureau has had historically with corporate Canada. And so I really applaud him for that. And that toughening up of that relationship is really important for ensuring that the system actually works for the benefit of Canadians, not for big corporate interests. Part of that capture and that cozy relationship between the Competition Bureau and corporate Canada is historical more than anything. The reason why you had this closer relationship is because many of the experts in this area of law worked in private law firms that were representing business interests, right? And it had to do more with a deficit of internal expertise at the Competition Bureau. So the Competition Bureau and the legislators that were crafting, revising, updating legislation relied a lot on these experts in competition law that worked in the private sector, representing the businesses that were ultimately being regulated by the competition law. And so it created a little bit of a conflict, as you can imagine. And I want to say that it's important for businesses to have their say in how the law should work and have a say in how they're regulated. I don't think we should completely shut off their voices. That's not productive. But those voices need to be balanced with the interests of consumers, with the interests of workers, and with the interests of small business as well. And what was really missing are those other voices. And those voices were missing because they lacked expertise in the competition laws and regulations we have today. That's changed a lot. And CAMP has played an important role in that by giving voice to consumers, workers, and small businesses. So the mechanism of that capture has shifted because we now have a more engaged civil society that understands the problems that monopoly creates and is able to effectively engage in conversations around competition law and competition policy.
So you'd mentioned something about, you know, how businesses should play a role in determining how they are regulated. And I think that's more relevant than ever in some sectors of tech where there's, especially the new, completely new sectors, the lawmakers generally seem to have a longer lead time in understanding new sectors and how to regulate them. So, you know, you'd recently written a post titled "Are Regulatory Moats Canada's Form of Corruption?" And, you know, in that piece, you describe an example of the regulatory system for ride hailing in Toronto. And I think it kind of goes to the heart of what you were saying. So could you explain what is a regulatory moat and why is this this system in Toronto for ride hailing a regulatory moat?
Yeah, so a regulatory moat happens when you have a regulation set up by government that prevents and undermines competition. And that moat can happen and be created two ways. And they're not exclusive. These two ways can happen at the same time too. So the first could be just ignorance, right? Lawmakers, government officials, they may not understand that this important regulation that they're making that has a valid reason is designed in a way that actually is inhibiting competition and giving preference to monopolies or other dominant businesses, right? And so the solution to that problem is education. We need to be doing more to educate lawmakers and people within government to understand how to craft regulations so that we're not protecting dominant businesses from potential competition and giving them free rein to exploit consumers and workers. The second way regulatory moats happen is when you have a dominant business that enters into a new market and lobbies government to create regulations that protect them from potential competition. And part of why they can get away with that is because the lawmakers and government officials are ignorant. They don't understand that these regulations being proposed by the lobbyists are actually undermining competition and entrenching the power of these dominant corporate interests. So this is very much the case of ride-hailing services in Toronto. So I've teamed up with some local activists in the city to do an analysis of the ride-hailing regulations in Toronto. And the reason why we're digging into this issue is because the city of Toronto is reviewing these regulations. And what's really clear is that these regulations do protect dominant ride-hailing businesses, mainly Uber, from competition. And it's no wonder, because these regulations were shaped in large part by the lobbying interests of Uber. Uber, when they entered Toronto, had some draft regulation ready to go, and they gave it to the city. And the city really took that in, and that shaped a lot of the regulation we have today. The main problem with the regulation in Toronto has to do with how drivers for ride-hailing companies receive licenses from the city of Toronto. So if you want to drive for Uber, you have to apply for a license to drive in the city through Uber. And that license is tied to Uber. This is very different from how taxis work. If you're a taxi driver and you want a license to be a taxi driver in Toronto, you apply for that license directly with the city. And with that license, you can drive for any broker. However, if you're a ride-hailing driver and you get your license through Uber, you can only drive for Uber. So you could see how this situation makes it hard for drivers to switch between platforms. And this is really the core of the problem. and it creates problems for drivers because it's harder for them to switch platforms if a platform is treating them like crap. And it's also hard for new platform companies to enter the market and compete for drivers. If drivers can't switch to new platforms who may be entering the market, some examples are Bolt, which is a ride-hailing company based in Europe. Also Hover, which is a homegrown ride-hailing company here in Toronto. If these companies cannot compete for drivers in the Toronto marketplace, it prevents them from being an effective competitor against Uber. So in essence, Uber has captured many of the drivers in the city, and it undermines competition, hurting drivers and ultimately riders too.
So you suggested making changes, if we understand you right, to enable drivers to have licenses for multiple platforms. Is that the case in other jurisdictions? And you know, what were the results? And how does Toronto compare more broadly to other jurisdictions in Canada and in North America in this regard?
Yeah, well, I can't speak in much detail to how licensing works in other cities in Canada. But what I can say is that there are some pretty big differences between how licensing works in Toronto versus other global cities like London or New York. And one of the big differences is that the licensing system in London and New York is much more involved. The cities there have a much larger role to play in issuing licenses. And as a result, they charge ride-hailing companies more to operate in the city. So in Toronto, ride-hailing companies pay very little to the city to operate. And these fees are important for funding the city and ensuring that the city has the resources to issue licenses and effectively regulate the market. Versus in London and Toronto, where ride-hailing companies pay much more, like in the hundreds of thousands of dollars per year, to operate in these markets. And they're regulated to a much higher standard, which not only benefits drivers, but it actually makes ride-hailing in the city work better because the city has the resources it needs to effectively regulate the market. Drivers are treated better. And so there's more supply of drivers and it's a better driving experience for riders. So you have better working ride-hailing markets in these cities where you have proper regulation versus in Toronto, where we have insufficient regulation. And as a result, drivers really suffer.
So, you know, I think in recent years, we've seen this kind of effort across different industries to, through mergers and acquisitions, obviously, to that they've gotten quite concentrated. And you've talked a little bit about why that is. But, you know, the case is often made in this, like, highly competitive international market that you know, countries need to promote a small number of national champions in order to compete with globally dominant, like, multinationals. And, you know, we see countries like the United States and Korea embrace this approach to apparent success. So what are your thoughts on this approach of making Canadian companies globally competitive by allowing them to kind of concentrate in industries?
Yeah, well, you know what? Like, the point you bring up is a point that a lot of people make. And I think that this line of thinking made sense in the past when our economy was more manufacturing based and you really needed to set up these big factories in order to be cost competitive with other companies elsewhere in the world. But business models have changed so much, especially with the rise of the digital economy. When you think of some of the largest businesses in Canada, I think of Shopify as a great example. They're a large digital business, and scale to them it's not so much about how big your factory is, it's about how many users are on your platform. And we often talk in economics about what are called zero marginal cost business models. And social media and other digital businesses are great examples of this, where adding a new client really doesn't cost you that much more, right? In fact, the cost might be zero. And actually, on top of that, having more clients or users of your service or platform is actually beneficial, because you get value from that broader network of users, right? And that's the crux behind social media, right? The more people you have on the platform, the more people want to be on the platform. It's like a snowballing effect. So this type of business model has very different mechanics from the traditional way that we have done business in the past, where we're manufacturing something and you need to get really, really big in order to jump into the global market and compete effectively. These digital businesses, they're already operating on a global scale. We don't need to accommodate business dominance in our local market as the price of global success, right? So ultimately, I think that argument just doesn't hold a lot of water today, because business has changed fundamentally, and our competition law and the way we approach it needs to change accordingly.
So one thing that that I kind of have had a question about, you know, generally when it comes to competition and competition law, I think we hear a lot about antitrust legislation and antitrust legislation enforcement at the federal level. But a question that, you know, that comes to me is what kind of role do the provincial governments play with kind of dealing with these companies of this size? And I want to put one example to you, the example of Sasktel, right, in Saskatchewan. Mm-hmm. And so what are your thoughts on say, like a provincial government and playing that kind of role of being a player in this industry, therefore, you know, possibly driving down the price for consumers?
Oh, great question. And I think you're totally onto something there. There was a study done by the Competition Bureau. And the study was done, I think, around like 2016. And the Competition Bureau did this study when they were reviewing the potential merger between Bell and MTS. Now, MTS was the Manitoba telecom provider in Manitoba. So it was a regional provincial provider. And Bell wanted to purchase MTS. And ultimately, they were allowed to do so, which I think was a big mistake. But that's not the point. The point being that during this investigation, the Competition Bureau did a study. And what they did is they looked across all of Canada and they compared provinces that had a regional competitor like Sasktel to provinces where there was no regional competitor. And what they found empirically through statistical modeling is that provinces that have that regional competitor have better prices. So we know when there are more options, people get lower prices. And I think that there is a really important role for provinces to play in providing that alternative. And Sasktel is a perfect example of that. There's also an opportunity for provinces to be regulating mergers and acquisitions themselves. Especially in instances where you have mergers happening in smaller marketplaces, where the Competition Bureau, whose job it is to monitor for these types of mergers and acquisitions, they may not be able to identify them because they are smaller, they're regional, and the Competition Bureau just doesn't have enough eyeballs to investigate or identify, I should say, like every merger acquisition that happens in Canada. However, provinces as well as municipalities have a role to play in flagging mergers and acquisitions that could be really harmful to communities and sharing this information with the Competition Bureau. That's another great way that provinces can support more competition and curb corporate power. And another area where provinces have started to do more in promoting competition has to do with employment contracts and what are called non-compete clauses. So competition also has a really important impact on workers. And when businesses prevent their employees from leaving to join other businesses or leaving to start their own business through non-compete and non-solicitation clauses, it can really undermine competition in the context of workers and labor markets. Ontario has taken steps to actually ban non-compete clauses within employment contracts. And while it seems like a kind of technical, legal, jargon thing, it actually has a really important impact on the livelihoods of people. So provinces elsewhere could be looking to Ontario and taking similar steps, which would not only enhance competition, but also bring beneficial outcomes to workers. So those are just some examples of how provinces could be doing more in this area.
So they could, you know, ostensibly be players in these industries themselves, but they could also play a regulatory role. And it's really interesting that you said that about the municipalities, because I for one, never really thought about municipalities being, I guess, you know, large enough to regulate anything relating to, like, say, something as significant as an antitrust issue. But that's quite interesting. In terms of, say, you did mention, you know, about data collection and data sharing. Is there some sort of framework right now for, like, say, what, besides, say, the CRA having a list of businesses, and what is, like, you know, if a BC company is taking over another BC company, would that be on the Competition Bureau's radar, or is that what you're suggesting should be shared with them?
Yeah, so today the Competition Bureau can monitor mergers and acquisitions that are above a certain threshold. So if the value of the deal approximately is over $90 million, then what needs to happen is the companies have to notify the Competition Bureau and say, hey, we're merging. And the Competition Bureau does a review of that merger. But this only happens for really big mergers. There are all sorts of companies and merger and acquisition deals across Canada that are less than $90 million. Like, $90 million is a lot, right? So there's a big gap in the Competition Bureau's ability to monitor the Canadian landscape. But more local governments could play a role in helping to fill that gap. And I think it's really important that they step in to do this, because mergers that are maybe not huge, but happen in local communities can have real impacts on both the people who rely on these businesses as consumers, but also for the people who work for these businesses, especially if we're talking about more remote or smaller communities where there are fewer employers available for certain types of workers, or where there are fewer options for people that are looking to purchase the goods and services that they need, right? So I think it comes back to that idea of literacy, right? And having lawmakers and people in government learn more about how important it is to promote competition and, well, as an aim to ultimately curbing the outsized power of corporations within our economy.
I think, you know, one thing that, you know, most listeners or most people kind of, that's most front of mind for them, I guess, is, you know, grocery stores and just like the increasing prices in grocery stores. I just, specifically on that issue, you know, if you could just give like some sort of description of what are the dynamics there that are causing, in your mind, you know, may potentially increase in prices or, you know, other dynamics that you observe in that industry?
Yeah, well, one of the things that people don't always understand about grocery, and something that I'll do a little plug here for some of my colleagues. So Vass Bednar and Denise Hearn, who are two friends and colleagues of mine, recently wrote a book about competition policy in Canada called The Big Fix. And in their book, they talk about grocery stores and they make the point that really there are a small number of grocery stores in Canada, but there's an illusion that there's actually choice. And this is because companies like Loblaw actually operate under various different brands and banners, Superstore, Loblaw, TNT, and Shoppers Drug Mart, and the list goes on. And so we have this illusion that there's product variety and choice, but in reality, our grocery sector is really dominated by a small number of large corporate entities. The same is true when it comes to telecom. We think that there's variety with Bell, Rogers, Virgin Mobile, Kudu, all these other brands. But in reality, these brands are all part of conglomerates, telecom conglomerates, where Bell, Rogers, and Telus are operating under several different banners. So it creates this illusion of choice. And so when it comes to grocery, that illusion of choice compounds with another particular tactic, which is private label. So when you go to, say, a Loblaw and you look at a shelf, you may think to yourself, wow, there's lots of product variety and choice here. But actually, many of those products are also owned by Loblaw. And they are presented as no name, black label, etc. So there are a variety of different brands that look like there are options. But in reality, it's all the same company. And so ultimately, the problem here is that you're not only getting worse pricing, because when Loblaw runs or operates or sells nearly half of what's on a shelf itself, it can set whatever prices it wants. There's no actual competition. But it also is really bad for businesses who want to be selling product on Loblaw's shelf, because if Loblaw is going to choose between putting its product on a shelf or putting a competitor's product on the shelf, well, it's going to put its product. So here you have grocery stores who dominate the actual grocery store market, right? The number of locations. And then on top of that, they're increasingly taking over and dominating the shelf space. And it pushes out other food producers from the marketplace. So ultimately, food production, or rather food retail, becomes increasingly more and more captured by these large dominant players in the retail space.
All right. So we are just about to end the show. But before we go, I do want to ask you, Robin, you know, if listeners were to leave with a few systemic anti-monopoly next steps, you know, we've talked a lot about how we got here. In a nutshell, in like an elevator pitch fashion, if you could tell us what some concrete next steps are, systemic anti-monopoly next steps that, you know, consumers should look into and advocate our representatives to adopt, what would they be?
Yeah, well, I would first say, maybe it's a bit of a shameless plug, but please check out the Canadian Anti-Monopoly Project and sign up for our newsletter. Every week we post news about anti-monopoly themes and issues in the Canadian and global economy. And it's an important tool for staying up to date on current events and also wins in this area. I also want people to know that we've had a lot of great success transforming law in Canada to make things better. There's still more that from a policy perspective we need to do. And so having your political support on that and talking to your political representatives is really important. So you can stay up to date on what CAMP is doing and what the current issues are by joining our newsletter.
Perfect. And I understand we can, our listeners can find more of your writings on the Open Mind Economics Substack.
That's right. Thanks.
Thank you so much for joining us, Robin. It was a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Perfect. Few other things to wrap up. You can find us at The Irman Akil on Instagram and Twitter. So check us out there. If you like the show, please leave us a review on Spotify. And you can subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts.
The music for the show is composed by the inexorable music talents of Sarah Pratt. Every note she writes is a gift to humanity, elevating our souls to heights we never reached. Existed. We do have some awesome shows and sets of guests lined up for you. Do continue to listen and subscribe.